From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. As Israel marks the 60th anniversary of its founding as an independent Jewish democracy, some of the same voices shouting in celebration are also asking how much longer the country can survive. The Arab minority is about to become the majority, and many of them are Palestinian.
You know, one Palestinian story is essentially our collective story.
And that story doesn't portray Israel very well. Even some Israeli Jews have doubts about their country's direction. One of the country's most respected novelists is Meir Shalev, who thinks his country's gone far afield from its founder's vision.
It's not the kind of society our visionaries have dreamt about, and it's not the kind of society that people like me can find some kind of satisfaction in.
There is a wide slash across a recent issue of The Atlantic magazine with a bold question: is Israel finished? Jeffrey Goldberg, who wrote the cover story, certainly hopes not, but his story explores the division confounding Israel. A trio of the country's best-known and most respected writers has publicly disagreed with Ehud Olmert, the country's prime minister. Novelist David Grossman no longer speaks to him. If that sort of thing happened here, the reaction might be a huge, so what? But in Israel, according to Goldberg, writers matter.
Novelists in particular in Israel have a broader public role than they have in this country. Israelis buy more books per capita than any other group of people. And these guys are also, the interesting thing about them to me is that they're deeply engaged in the life of their country. The writer I focus on, David Grossman, is well known now in part because of a tragedy that occurred to his family. His son, one of his sons, was killed in the Lebanon War. He was a tank commander. So these guys have credibility in part because they're so deeply engaged in the life of their country.
These are names, actually, that are known not just in Israel, too. There's David Grossman and Amos Oz. The third one you mentioned is Yoshua, whom I know less.
Yeah.
But they're very well known within the literary communities inside and outside of Israel.
These are the Updikes and the Roths. I mean, these are the heavyweights. One of the things that's interesting about them is how Zionist they are. This is something that sort of almost surprised me. I know I've read them, and I know what they say, and I know that they're associated with the political left in Israel, but one of the sort of surprising things about them is how troubled they are by the direction Israel is going in, not because they're opposed to the idea of Israel, but because they're in favor of the idea of a Jewish state in the Middle East, and they're afraid that it's going off the rails, and they want to protect the original dream, if you will, of a Jewish democracy, of a Jewish democratic state. And so they're really at the forefront of people talking about this issue today. And so it seemed natural to focus on them, in particular on Grossman, because he's become, I think in some ways, the leading, to borrow an American term, the leading public intellectual in Israel.
And he's been writing about this for a long time. Just before we started on air, we were talking about a book that he wrote, what, in the 1980s, 86?
I think
The Yellow Wind?
The Yellow Wind, he reported it in 1986. Like, it came out in serial form in a newspaper in Israel before the first Palestinian uprising broke out, immediately before, and it was published as a book in 88, right after that. But it's an amazing act of prophecy. I mean, you know, obviously Israel produces prophecy throughout history. Most of it's wrong. But this guy really is the closest thing to a Jeremiah or an Amos, not to give him too much credit here, but he's really the closest thing to a prophet Israel has. He wrote this not knowing, of course, that a Palestinian uprising would occur that would change forever the political dynamic of the Middle East. But he predicted it, in essence. He went around the West Bank just with his reporter pad and an open mind, and he came to realize that what was happening was not sustainable.
But what's fascinating is that he was saying then many of the same things that he's saying now. You talk about how important he is because he has achieved notoriety with the death of his son in the invasion of Lebanon. But it hasn't basically changed what he's saying. It maybe has increased his passion. But it isn't as though he didn't know before.
He actually wrote this in The Yellow Wind. He was in a I think it was in Bethlehem, and there was a riot going on outside at the university, and the thought crossed his mind, what would happen if I'm attacked or if I'm hurt or killed? He posited, okay, so let's assume I'm hurt. Would my attitudes about this situation change? And he didn't give us the answer, in the book. He didn't want to reveal what he thought would happen. But I think that we know now, based on what happened to his family, that he did not move to the right upon the death of his son at the hands of Hezbollah. He doesn't downplay or mitigate what Hezbollah is or what Hamas is as organizations. He calls them vile anti-Semitic terrorist organizations. But he's come back to his roots as an activist in favor of a two-state compromise. He hasn't lost the passion for that as the solution.
20 years, 20 years, 20 years. I was thinking in The Yellow Wind, he writes about how in 1967 he was just of bar mitzvah age, which means 13 or so, and feeling the power of the Six-Day War. At the time you're writing about, the time of the article, the Lebanese War, this is almost 40 years later. And it was becoming clear, not just to three writers, of course, but to most of the people in the State of Israel, that this was not going to be another Six-Day War. But people still, and again, not just the writers, they want the future of Israel to be solid. So who do they fall behind? Do they go along with the writers who protest this, whom they can believe in, or do they look to the government?
Do you mean the average Israeli?
Yeah.
Well, this is one of the tragedies that I try to write about in this Atlantic article, is that you have a prime minister right now, Ehud Olmert, who is a very flawed person as a politician, but he seems to grasp better than anyone else who's held that job the necessity for Israel to make some sort of dramatic change in the way it relates to the West Bank and to the Palestinians. He understands the demographic problem, for instance, that at a certain point in the near future, there will be more Arabs under Israeli control than Jews. And he understands the implications of that for Israeli democracy. And so rhetorically, he's not that far away from these leading literary figures of the left. What's happened, though, is that there's a paralysis in Israeli politics, that no one in politics as an individual is strong enough to actually push through the hard decisions that need to be made. And without going into it in too great detail, David Grossman, of course, has very hard feelings about Ehud Olmert, who led Israel during that Lebanon war in which his son was killed. And he doesn't speak to him now. But he said to me that if he felt that there was something that he could do to help Olmert really make some hard decisions, not just make speeches, but really make hard decisions, he would get behind the prime minister. The majority of Israelis, as we know from polls, want a two-state solution, want territorial compromise. What they lack now is a, for lack of a better term, a reasonable enemy, one with which they think they can negotiate. And they also lack strong leadership of the sort that Israel used to have. I'm thinking of Yitzhak Rabin, of course, as the last really strong moral leader, and he's been gone for some time already.
When we talk about this issue, it isn't going anywhere. Why is that? What is holding Israel back from what seems an increasingly obvious need?
Well, the most obvious answer is the behavior of the Palestinians in Gaza after the Israeli withdrawal 3 years ago. If you recall, Ariel Sharon withdrew all of the settlements and all of the soldiers from Gaza unilaterally, decided that it wasn't in Israel's best interest, and he did what the Palestinians said they wanted him to do, which was to leave Gaza. What happened? Hamas takes over Gaza and begins firing rockets into Israel. So the average Israeli, for good reason, says to himself, well, we tried that in Gaza and it didn't work. So why should we try this in the West Bank? Of course, the West Bank is more strategically centrally located. The West Bank is a few miles from Israel's main airport. It's 12 miles from Tel Aviv, its largest city. So if we get out of the West Bank, the assumption is, this is what most Israelis feel, they simply feel that there's no one to talk to on the other side, that if we leave this territory, it will be seen by the other side not as compromise, but as a victory for the other side. And the other side will use the territory it gains from us to fire rockets into our cities. So that is the, it's a whole separate discussion about the self-destructiveness of Palestinian politics. But that is the main reason why politics in Israel is so paralyzed. That said, there are also domestic reasons why it's so paralyzed. The settlement movement represents only about 3 or 4% of the people, but they're highly politically organized, and they have disproportionate support in the Knesset. And the government system, the way the government is set up as a coalition government in Israel, means that it's inherently unstable, that small parties, parties that control 3 or 4 or 5 seats in the 120-member Knesset or parliament, have disproportionate power because they can pull out of the government and cause the government to fall. It's not a very stable way of organizing a democracy, and so small parties have disproportionate power.
Again, I was thinking about Grossman and the Yellow Wind interviewing Palestinians. Even in the 80s, it was clear that the Palestinians who had grown up under occupation were in no mood to do anything but hate the Israelis. What kind of a two-state solution do even these good-hearted men believe is possible?
Look, nobody thinks that this is going to be some sort of kumbaya festival in the Middle East. What they want, and this is what Rabin talked about, what they want to do is arrange, let's call it an amicable divorce between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They don't have lofty visions of everybody gathering around the table and breaking bread and making peace. What they believe is that both peoples are wounded. Both peoples need time alone, a generation, 2 generations, 3 generations, in order to decide what they are, what their nationality means. After that, who knows what's possible? We are, after all cousins over there. But they certainly do believe that the only solution for Israel, the only solid future for Israel, comes by the creation of a Palestinian state, that without a Palestinian state, you're talking about a one-state solution. A one-state solution, of course, is shorthand or a euphemism for the dissolution of Israel as a Jewish state. I argue in the article that the true Zionist position at this point in history is for a Palestinian state, because if a Palestinian state and a viable Palestinian state doesn't emerge on the West Bank in particular, then I don't see a long-term future for Israel as a Jewish majority democratic state.
Jeffrey Goldberg is the author of Prisoners, A Story of Friendship and Terror, and he wrote a recent cover story about Israel for The Atlantic magazine. Palestinians and Israelis may view each other with intractable mistrust or worse, but recently 2 writers from the opposing camps came by our studios to read from their work. Susan Abolawa is of Palestinian descent and the author of The Scar of David, a novel set in the world of the refugee camps. Margot Singer is an American Jew whose new book of stories is called The Pale of Settlement. Steve Paulson got them to put all their baggage down and answer some questions.
Now, there are some very interesting intersections between both of your books because you actually touch on some of the same ground. Obviously, you come at it from very different perspectives. I don't just mean political. I mean just in terms of how these events are framed in your books. For instance, you both deal with what happened in the Palestinian refugee camp of Jenin in 2002. And Susan, weren't you there during part of the violence?
I was, yeah. When I heard what was happening, I was working at a drug company at the time, and I just took my vacation and bought a ticket and went there. And what struck me, besides the, you know, the horror of it and the smell of death, was the near absence of anyone from the international community who wasn't an activist. There was a scarcity of reporters, and also, as you may know, the people who ended up writing the official UN report did not step foot in that camp, nor did they interview any of the victims or the soldiers who were there.
Wasn't there a big controversy? And in fact, isn't there still a big controversy about how many people were actually killed in the camp? And I know the Israeli government says one thing. Many Palestinians who were there put the number much higher.
Yes. You know, I personally helped dig up 3 bodies, and I saw several more that other workers were digging up. There were reports, eyewitness reports, that in the 2 weeks that the camp was closed after the fighting had subsided and Israel was firmly in there, that bodies were being carried out to some undisclosed location. I think this was touched upon in either the Amnesty or Human Rights Watch report. But I also know that hundreds of people remained missing at that time. Their bodies weren't found. So You know, I mean, whether it was 50 or 300, the controversy was whether to call it a massacre or not. I don't know where you put the number.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny that you use that word because that actually comes up, Margot, in one of your stories in your collection. There are journalists who are reporting on this, Western journalists, and, well, there's a debate about whether to call it a massacre. Could you read that passage?
Sure. On Monday, Debbie filed a piece saying that the Israelis were pulling out of Kalkalia and Tulkarem, but that the fighting in Jenin was growing worse. She quoted the director of the Jenin hospital saying that Israeli tanks were not allowing ambulances to evacuate the dead and wounded from the camp. The Palestinian Authority issued a statement today claiming that, quote, the Sabra and Shatila massacres are being repeated in Jenin, unquote. Here in New York, it was still raining. They were predicting that it might change over to sleet later in the day. In Israel, it was probably nice and warm. Once, she'd gone with her cousin, Gavi, to the Galilee to pick irises and anemones in the spring. She cradled the receiver against her shoulder, squinting at the screen. Can we really say that it's a massacre? She said. We're not saying it, Debbie said after a slight delay. The PA is. Susan scrolled down the page. As many as 100 Palestinians have been killed in Jenin alone. The line crackled, fading in and out. Where are you, in your car? Susan said. You sure about 100? We need attribution. Yesterday we said 74 over the past 10 days, and not just in Jenin. And what about the Israeli side? 100 is what everyone is saying, Debbie said, her voice abruptly clear. And from what I've heard, she added, it's probably much worse than that. But they're still not letting journalists into the camp. Susan backspaced over as many as and typed at least instead. She looked at her watch. It was getting late. Okay, she said. I'll see what Bill thinks. If I need anything else, I'll call you back.
Now, this is such an interesting passage because, of course, this is a very real issue for journalists. I mean, how do you label something like this in a news story? It's not as obvious that this fits into a collection of short stories, into fiction. Tell me how you came to write a passage like that.
Well, the character Susan is a journalist, and I really struggled with this story. In one early draft, I wanted her to go over and do what Susan did and be there. And because I didn't have the chance to do that myself, it was a terrible draft. And so I put her in New York in the newsroom, which I think is where a lot of American journalists were. And she's working with Debbie, who's a stringer, who's over there, you know, calling in dispatches on her cell phone. So that's where the scene came out of. And I wanted to somehow capture the struggle to figure out what's happening and to put it into the language of the news story. And the wonderful thing about writing fiction, and I'm interested in fiction that sort of spans that border of fiction and creative nonfiction, is that you can step back and allow the text itself to raise questions that the news story format doesn't let you do. I personally did a ton of, as much research as I could. I read all the reports, UN and Human Rights Watch, the Time Magazine, Newsweek wrap-ups. I read all the daily dispatches in one newspaper that I imagined was the one my character worked for. And I tried to incorporate the reality that the so-called facts being reported were sort of all over the place, and yet to keep the perspective of a good-hearted journalist trying to do the right thing.
Well, Susan, let me ask how you approached this in your novel. I mean, you were there. Obviously, mm-hmm. this experience affected you powerfully. And I think you wrote some newspaper columns about it, right?
I did, yeah.
So how did it figure into the shaping of this novel?
Actually, my experience in Jenin was in some ways the impetus for writing this novel. I was overwhelmed by the sense of how much Jenin had been violated and how their story just was obscured in so many ways. And that was, in a large part, the drive to want to tell their story. And, you know, in doing that, I wanted to tell the Palestinian story. And to do that, I think being historically accurate is imperative.
But why do fiction? I mean, why not stay with newspaper accounts? Why not write a book of nonfiction?
I think fiction has a unique power to tell history. You know, there are so many nonfiction books about the Middle East conflict that are written in the cold prose of textbooks and numbers and facts. But it's an entirely different experience to live with a family as it moves through that history.
Could you read a passage from your book, which is talking about some things that happened in Jenin?
Here we are now. I see his contact lenses swimming in his eyes and sweat bubbling on his forehead. I feel an inexplicable serenity. Death, and the certainty of it, is exacting its due respect and repose before it takes my hand. But he does not shoot. He blinks hard, and a solitary drop of sweat travels from his brow, down the side of his face. I watch it fall, and note his smooth skin, still too young to need a regular shave. The power he holds over life is a staggering burden for so young a man. He knows it and wants it lifted. He is too handsome not to have a girlfriend nervously waiting for his return. He would rather be with her than with his conscience, with his burden, or with me. I know he has killed before. He knows I know. But he has never seen his victim's face. My eyes, soft with a mother's love and a dead woman's calm, weigh him down with his own power, and I think he will cry. Not now, later, when he is face to face with his dreams and his future. I feel sad for him, sad for the boy bound to the killer. I'm sad for the youth betrayed by their leaders for symbols and flags and war and power. For an instant, I think he could be my nephew, but no, Yuri has no doubts of his duty to kill for Israel, and Jacob does not serve in the military. This soldier is not my nephew. Strange, strange, he's handsome, and I loving.
Susan Abalawa is the founder of Playgrounds for Palestine. Her novel is called The Scar of David. Margot Singer's written a collection of linked stories called The Pale of Settlement. Steve Paulson talked with them. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Meir Shalev fits the profile of the other Israeli novelists we've heard about this hour. He still writes a regular column for one of his country's major daily newspapers. Meanwhile, his literature has been translated into over 20 languages and won many awards, including the Brenner Prize, Israel's most prestigious. His latest novel, A Pigeon and a Boy, tells a pair of love stories, one set in present-day Israel and one set during the war that established the country.
This is the war between the Israelis and Palestinians and neighboring Arab countries after the Arabs refused to accept the plan of partition of Palestine between the Jewish people and the Palestinian people. There was a very detailed plan of partition. The Jewish population accepted it. The Arab population refused it and declared war and started a war, which they lost. And this is also the start of the terrible tragedy of the Palestinians, the refugee problem that had not been solved ever since.
You have been to war. You were born in 1948 and you fought in 1967.
Yes, I was born in the middle of the 1948 war. My mother, who was in the 8th month of pregnancy, had to go through a dangerous, adventurous journey through the hills surrounding Jerusalem. And she managed to escape with the help of her brother. And she gave birth to me 3 weeks later in a hospital in the Valley of Jezreel, where the same very brother was already hospitalized. And we met again in the same hospital 19 years later with me lying wounded in bed. And they are visiting me this time. I was hit by 4 bullets in 1967, not in the war itself, but in another operation a little later. The injury is very similar to the one my character, the pigeon handler, suffered in the battle I describe. And I know how battle feels and smells and sound and seen, and I know the feeling of being hit by bullets.
That comes across in the way that you write about it.
I didn't have to do much research about that. I interviewed many pigeon handlers and tourist guides and bird watchers for this book, but I could describe the feeling of war firsthand.
Now, you, of course, have lived through all of the times that you mm-hmm. write your stories about. Does that help or not when trying to create this? Because there is so much tension, at least as seen from the outside, that it almost overshadows any story you might want to tell.
I must tell you that maybe from the outside it looks much more tense and hard than it really is in Israel. I live in Israel all my life. I never left the country for more than 5 consecutive weeks. And I am experiencing everything that can be experienced in Israel. And yet I'm able to write my novels and raise my children. And my wife is far more important and influential in my life than the prime minister or the minister of defense. And there is, if you are able to create this, I would say, a professional atmosphere of writing, of being a writer, then you don't have to let politics infiltrate into your books. Some writers like to do it. They like to write political novels and mix their politics and their literary art. I try to separate the two things. I have a column in the paper in Israel. I publish every weekend a political column in which I react and express my opinions, but my novels are non-political.
Well, maybe in part what you're saying, and you can disagree, is that in writing a book like A Pigeon and a Boy, you are revealing an aspect of Israel that the political novelist doesn't consider, the reality of daily life that makes a man care more about the opinions of his wife than of the prime minister.
Maybe, and I'm happy if people who will read the book will see this aspect of my book, because I tell you this honestly, that even though life in Israel, I'm sure they are not as relaxed as in some countries in Europe or in America, but still we also have love life and family life and relationships between parents and children and two brothers and sisters-in-law that have nothing to do with the Israeli politics or the Palestinian problem.
I do want to talk to you a little bit about your politics, if you are willing, because as you say, you are well known in Israel and in
yes.
Europe. I read a recent article, for instance, that you wrote in which you said that you had fought in the 1967 war mm-hmm. and considered the results of it detrimental to Israel.
I'm one of the few people in Israel who said that right after the Six-Day War ended. I was just a young soldier then, and nobody had any reason to listen to me except my father, who was very angry when I said that at home when I came back from the war. But I was afraid even then, and I'm sorry to be found right, that Israel will become a slave of its own victory, because ever since, in the last 40 years since the Six-Day War, all what we do in Israel is dealing with the outcomes of the 1967 war, of our great victory. We deal with ruling the Palestinians, oppressing them, avoiding them from committing terrorist actions against us. We are dealing with the settlers. We are dealing with the lack of budget, because too much money is going to security and to settlements. Our priorities order have changed completely. We were once a nation dedicated to education, research, learning, studying, teaching. We are not anymore. You can see it in the level of students that we have in Israel. And this is something that I am mourning about. It's not the kind of society our visionaries have dreamt about, and it's not the kind of society that people like me can find some kind of satisfaction in. We do not appreciate anymore the people that Jewish tradition always appreciated, which are the learned people. the whole atmosphere of the Israeli society have changed because of this victory of the Six-Day War, and I'm very sorry about it.
There is an Israel that you hint at in the novel that existed in 1948 that was different and, to you at least, better.
Yeah, I think that the 1948 war, even though it brought these terrible results for the Palestinian people, was a just war on the Israeli side because it was not declared by the Israeli, it was not started by the Israeli people. We could have separated the land into two parts according to the UN proposition of 1947. But I think that the Six-Day War was a completely different story. We had to respond to the aggression around us, but then the decision to keep the occupied territories for ourselves or the lack of decision not to give it back, this, I think, was a terrible mistake. We lost some kind of wisdom and practicality in this war. This great victory of 1967 made us blind.
Is there a way back that you can see?
There is a way back, but it becomes harder and harder the more we wait. And I'm afraid soon it will become impossible. The way back is known to all sides involved. It means that the Israelis have to give up their victory of 1967 and give back the territories that they occupied in this war, and that the Palestinians have to give up their idea of coming back to their homes and territories of before 1948. This is the only way to solve the situation and create two states for the two people. It is a very painful operation for both sides. But I do not see any other possibility unless there will be people who will say, look, this conflict will be eternal. We will keep on fighting and we will have to manage our life according to that. But I think there is still a way to solve this situation.
Meir Shalev won Israel's most prestigious literary prize for his latest novel, A Pigeon and a Boy. And now it's time to meet a man who doesn't fit the profile of a typical Israeli novelist. Itka Karet writes explosively funny, almost surreal, short fiction. A new collection of his works just been published in English, The Girl on the Fridge, contains a story called The Summer of 76. Karet told Anne Strangechamps it's based on his own childhood. Here's an excerpt. On holidays, we'd go to visit Grandpa Reuven in Zikron, and when he shook my hand, he'd squeeze it so hard I cried. Then he'd yell at me that I was spoiled and needed to learn to shake hands like a man. He'd always tell my mother she was bringing me up all wrong, that she wasn't preparing me for life. Mom would apologize and say that actually she was preparing me. It was just that life today wasn't anything like life used to be, that today you didn't have to know how to make Molotov cocktails from alcohol and nails or how to kill for bread. It was enough to learn how to enjoy life. But Grandpa wouldn't let it go. He'd pinch my ear and whisper that if you want to know how to enjoy life, you also have to know what sadness is. Otherwise, it isn't worth a damn. I tried. But life was so beautiful then, that summer of 76, that no matter how hard I worked at it, I couldn't be sad about anything.
I'm the son of two Holocaust survivors. You know, my mother lost all her family in the Warsaw Ghetto. She saw her mother and brother murdered before her eyes. And there was these things that, you know, kind of growing up in the 70s that were basically the best years for Israel. It was after the great victory of the 67 war and before we realized that, you know, that occupying the territories had its moral problems. You know, it was just kind of those golden years where everybody loved us, and you know, and Israel won the Eurovision twice in a row, and we had the Israeli Miss Universe, and everything looked great. And I always kind of compared my childhood to my parents' terrible childhood, and I kind of felt that I'm living some sort of a limited life, you know, that it was only a very small part of that spectrum of life, that I wasn't experiencing all the emotions, the human emotions around.
You know, a lot of Americans, I think, have grown up thinking, when they think about Israeli literature, they think, they expect old-fashioned tales of life on the kibbutz, stories full of hope and strength and determination. And your stories are so different. Do you think of yourself as trying to capture the real Israel today, now, what it's like to live there?
Well, I bet, you know, there are many, many real Israels, but I'm trying to write about the Israel that I know about around me. You know, for me, an Israeli story is an Orthodox guy going into a McDonald's in a shopping mall and asking if the hamburger is kosher. You know, this is a true Israeli story of the 21st century for me. And many times, you know, when I go overseas and I have readings, there are all those people who love Israel, you know, mostly Jewish people that love Israel, and Israel represents something kind of abstract and very emotional for them. They generally get angry at me, you know. Like, you know, I had this woman saying to me, I've been to Israel in 58 and it's nothing like what you write about, you know. Why do you write those lies? And I think that they need this image of Israel and they want to keep it intact, and I have full empathy for that, you know. I'm saying many people in Israel would like to imagine the diaspora as a place full of Cossacks, you know, that kill Jewish men and rape Jewish women. It just makes your life easier, you know, when you keep this image in mind. So I think for many Jews overseas, kind of Israel is this safe haven, you know, this beautiful and pure place, and unfortunately it isn't.
Let's talk a little bit about how you as a writer are trying to capture that particular sensibility. Your stories, and especially in your new collection, The Girl on the Fridge, they're really short. I mean, this book contains, it's not a big book, and contains almost 50 stories. Is the conciseness and the shortness of your stories, does that partly grow out of your feeling about modern Israel?
For sure. I said once that I see my stories like explosions, you know, like eruptions. There are no slow explosions, there are no long explosions. It's just the stories, usually I think they're kind of documenting those fractures, those things that kind of move from one position to another, you know? So they don't have this kind of epic length breath, because I don't live in a reality that has epic length processes, you know? It's all kind of a bunch of minutes that kind of turn you upside down from one condition to another.
Your work is especially popular, I think, with a younger generation of Israeli readers. Is that how you think of your readership, as sort of a younger generation?
The kernel of my readers are people, I would say, in their 20s and 30s.
And what is it, do you think, about your writing that especially speaks to them?
Well, I think that most of my protagonists are outsiders, and I think that the Israeli society and the art representations of the Israeli society rarely used to speak about outsiders, you know. It's like it's a collective society, and the stories and the movies were about that collective. So I think that many people who really don't feel they completely belong, they can identify with those characters, they don't find their place in society.
You've also, your work is notable for having been made into a lot of films. I think I read somewhere something like 40 of your short stories have been filmed.
Yes.
That's really phenomenal. And you and your wife recently made a film, Jellyfish, which did very well at the Cannes Film Festival in 2007. Can you tell us a little bit about Jellyfish?
It's a screenplay that my wife wrote, and my wife, Shira Geffen, she's primarily a poet and a playwright, and it was a wonderful screenplay, which I loved from the first moment. And both of us were not film directors, so we just gave Shira's screenplay to the best directors in Israel, and they all hated it, you know. They didn't understand what it was about. So at some stage I said to my wife, you know, if we won't do it, then there won't be a film, you know.
Hmm. Well, again, unlike a lot of Israeli films, you know, nothing in the film really has much to do with the Arab-Israeli conflict. I mean, you see men and women who are too busy to cope with their aging parents, or intolerance towards a Filipina housekeeper who doesn't speak Hebrew, an insensitive boss who's really hard on his female employees. You know, these are stories about people that could be happening in many places, in New York City, for instance. Were you kind of partly making a point about the ways in which life in Israel is so very like life other places?
Well, you know, we never felt that there was something kind of strange or awkward about it, because she was telling a story that takes place in Israel and it wasn't about the conflict. But it was only when we tried to find some funding for the film, we realized that it's difficult to fund a film about Israel that doesn't deal with the conflict, you know? I think many people kind of reduce themselves to that conflict. But, and I think the Israeli identity, you know, the conflict is a huge part of it, but it's not the only thing about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know if in Italy they only do mafia films, you know? So other, the people there that, I don't know, they fall in love, there's parents there that leave their child behind, you know? There is an entire life there beyond that one specific thing, you know? I have some other things to talk about. Like, let's say Philippine workers' rights in Israel is an issue I want to speak about too, you know? And in Israel, like, you know, many things like foreign workers' rights are things that are very much neglected, because everybody thinks that first we'll solve the conflict and then we'll deal with that, you know.
Edgar Caretz just had another collection of his stories published in English. It's called The Girl on the Fridge. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him. What do you think? Do we need a new understanding of Israel for the 21st century? You can let us know at our website. The address is ttbook.org. We always like to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Ask the average American what our nation's primary security concern in the Middle East is, and chances are the answer will be oil. But if you could put the same question to the Founding Fathers, they'd be most worried about the Barbary pirates. Historian Michael Oren, renowned in his field for his exhaustive research, tells the colorful story of America's long involvement in the Middle East in his book Power, Faith, and Fantasy. Steve Paulson found it riveting.
I confess I had no idea the Middle East figured into U.S. foreign policy in the late 18th century, but you say this part of the world was a big problem for the New Republic right after the War for Independence.
At the time of America's independence in 1776, about one-fifth of all American exports overseas were going through the Middle East. America was a seafaring nation. These 13 colonies were along the shoreline, maritime countries, very, very heavily dependent on foreign trade. And four North African Middle Eastern kingdoms, Morocco, Tunis, Tripoli, and Algiers, were sending pirates out to prey on this trade. And it was literally destroying American commerce. Americans were afraid to ship goods on their own ships. And it posed an existential threat to the United States, which had a very, very fragile economy in its first years after independence.
So these ships were sailing into the Mediterranean Sea, and the pirates off of North Africa were just grabbing them, and in some cases holding the crew hostage.
Well, America faced its first hostage crisis in the Middle East in the 1780s, when 127 American sailors were taken prisoner by Algiers and Tripoli and enslaved.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that before the War for Independence, they were protected by the British Navy, the most powerful force in the world. But of course, at that point, the British Navy did not have much incentive to protect any American ships.
And even after the war, many Americans didn't want a navy. They were afraid of a navy. They'd had a bad experience with a big navy not too long ago, the British Navy. They were afraid that a navy would pose a threat to America's emerging democratic institutions. They were afraid that a navy could embroil the United States in European wars. And navies were very expensive to build, and America finished the war with a major war debt, didn't have the money to build warships. So there was a solid block of opinion in the United States that said they didn't want warships, and the United States was better off bribing these pirates not to attack American merchant ships than it was building ships and going off to attack the pirates.
So this was a huge debate, whether to negotiate with the pirates or whether to basically force them to allow American ships to go through.
It was a debate whether to depart from the age-old European practice, which was to bribe the pirates, or to embark on a uniquely American policy of fighting the pirates. But the debate went even further. It got caught up on the whole question of whether the United States should be loosely confederated, as they were between 1776 and 1789, whether the United States would be a plural noun or a singular noun, or whether the United States should federate under a central government, because you can't create a navy unless you have a government that's capable of raising taxes to make the navy. And so in 1787, when the delegates from the states convened in Philadelphia to discuss creating a constitution, the question of the Barbary pirate threat was very much on their minds.
Well, tell me what happened to instigate this formation of the Navy and basically to get American leaders to want to project power into that part of the world. I mean, there were some humiliating episodes, weren't there?
Terrible humiliating episode. They actually came after the formation of the Navy. The Navy created in 1794 was six frigates, one of which was the U.S. Philadelphia. U.S. Philadelphia ran aground while chasing a Tripolitan, as they were called, from Tripoli, Tripoli pirates, and the crew was held hostage for several years, a major hostage crisis. But the debate ran very, very deeply within the American political consciousness. It had to do with whether the United States was going to embark on this separate policy, distinguish itself from Europe, whether the United States was going to take this military effort across the ocean. It's a long way to go back then in this distant Middle East, whether the United States would get bogged down in a protracted Middle Eastern conflict. And it was a protracted conflict. The Barbary Wars lasted from 1783 to 1815. So really the longest military conflict the United States has ever fought was in the Middle East. Americans back in the later 18th century, early part of the 19th century, were facing many decisions that Americans today have to make in the Middle East.
Now, today we have a lot of scholars and entire research institutes that specialize in the Middle East. But 200 years ago, did Americans know anything about the Middle East or about Islam?
They knew very little about it. Most of their information was secondhand. They could talk to slaves, for example, in the South who had come from Arabic-speaking areas. One of their major sources of information on the Middle East was the book 1001 Arabian Nights, which is actually the second most popular book after the Bible on the colonial bookshelf. And this, of course, is a collection of medieval Persian tales that describe carpets orbiting minarets and harem girls that are very, very sensuous, Aladdin and Ali Baba, but bear no real resemblance to any real Middle East. So there's a tremendous amount of disinformation.
So the Orient was, I mean, it was seen as this land of mystery and exoticism.
And also of threat, it's important to say. You know, recently we've had a Congressman Ellison who has sworn in to Congress as America's first Muslim member of Congress, and he swore in on a Quran that was found in Thomas Jefferson's library. That Quran was a translation made by George Sales in 1734, and that Quran talks that the reason George Sales is translating this Quran is to warn good Protestants about the dangers of Islam. So there was very much a sense inherited, I think, from medieval times in early colonial America that this area of the world was not only mystical and romantic and erotic, but was also hostile and potentially dangerous.
Well, tell me about Thomas Jefferson, because he took these problems quite seriously. In fact, he said the Middle East was his major foreign policy concern.
In the second term of office, he listed his foreign policy priorities, and he listed relations with the Middle East as his number one priority for the simple reason that, again, these pirates were destroying American commerce overseas, and the country simply could not survive this type of depredations. Prior to the Jefferson administration, John Adams was paying as much as 20% of all federal revenues in bribery to North Africa. Extraordinary thing. Jefferson believed that the United States could not go on bribing the pirates, that the more you bribe them, the more they would demand. And he also had a sense of what he called the American temper. He believed that Americans would not abide by blackmail, that Americans strove to achieve what he called an erect and independent attitude in foreign policy. And he acted on it.
What eventually happened to end the Barbary Wars?
Well, eventually in 1815, under Madison's administration, after the War of 1812, when the pirates had resumed their attacks on American shipping, the American Navy was at that point quite strong. Madison sent a flotilla into Tripoli, Algiers, Tunis, and forced these kingdoms to surrender. And by doing so, the United States also embarrassed Europe to doing the same. The next year, a British and Dutch fleet sailed into these same harbors and forced the rulers to capitulate as well. By 1819, an international convention was signed ending Mediterranean piracy once and for all.
Now, most of this history that we've been talking about, going back to the late 1700s, the early 1800s, was a time when the United States was clearly not an imperial power. I mean, they were just starting to flex their muscle. When did the U.S. really start to project power in the Middle East?
Well, America projected significant power even at the beginning of the 19th century. America kept a permanent Mediterranean squadron on patrol intermittently throughout the early half of the 19th century. In the latter half of the 19th century, presidents pretty routinely sent warships into the Middle East to protect missionaries and other American citizens in the area. The U.S. Marines landed in the Middle East no less than 6 times over the course of the 19th century. But each time it was to protect U.S. citizens. But it's really only after World War II, when the United States emerges as one of the two world superpowers, and America begins to supplant Britain and France as the colonial powers, who were the former colonial powers in the Middle East. They were the major powers in the Middle East in post-War II. And finally, it's only after World War II, when oil becomes a major component in American foreign policy, that America becomes very much engaged in power and power projection in the Middle East.
Does this history matter? I mean, particularly the older history. I mean, is this useful to study for American policymakers today?
I think it's essential to study. I think that Americans today, certainly in the post-9/11 world at the height of the Iraq War, Americans are being asked to make fateful decisions about their policy in the Middle East. And these decisions will impact not only the future of Americans, but impact the future of much of the world. And I think it's essential to be able to make these decisions with them some type of historical point of reference in a context. I think it's essential to understand that Americans have faced similar situations in the past. It's important to understand how they dealt with those decisions and to gain an appreciation of their relative successes and failures so that we can repeat the successes and avoid those failures.
Historian Michael Oren lives in Jerusalem. His latest book is Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America in the Middle East, 1776 to the present. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 518A, Can Writers Save Israel? To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Carmen Jackson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.